Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Morning, buddy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man. Is that working good for you?
Yep. Looks like my call recorder is going, so we are in good shape.
Awesome. Just plugged it into the iPhone, and I think that's probably going to be the best, most reliable way to roll with it.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. All right, we'll dive right in here so we don't miss anything good.
Yeah, happy days. I've got to kick off work in about an hour and a half.
Happy days.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I am speaking into the future to Robert Herbert. It is 1 o'clock Thursday, my time, and it is Friday in Australia. How you doing, Herbie?
Yeah, good morning, mate. It's 7 o'clock over here. To be honest with you, I've been anxious all night about missing my snooze alarm, and I've hardly had a wink of sleep, but that's all good. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We should have done this probably many years ago. I'm trying to remember. A memory popped up on my Facebook. Back to when Kyrie and I went down to Australia to one of the deer shows down there, and I think that's the first time I met you was there, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've been chatting from my recollection. We've been chatting backwards and forwards as we do. I mean, social media is just such an awesome thing for those types of things. It can be bad for others, but getting to actually meet you face to face. I think that's one of your best shows that you'd had. You sold out a whole bunch of your bows, and you lost your voice, and it was a fantastic time, that show. Actually, funny you say that, because I think I've got it as one of my profile pictures on one of my social media accounts. It's a good memory.
Right on. Yeah, actually, I think to date that's still one of my, that is by far my best show. I can't remember. I either sold 13 or 17 bows because I brought 30 down. I either came home with 17 or I came home with 13. I just don't remember which one it was.
Then you went for a bit of a tour afterwards, I think. You got to stretch your legs a little bit and have a look at Victoria. And I think you might have gone to Costa Rica or somewhere for a while and just hung out down there and chilled for a bit.
Yeah, we went to, what's that little island with the penguins on it off of Sydney? Yeah.
Phillip Island,
there you go. Yep. My wife and I went there and hung out. It was a really nice, relaxing time. And I had been down to Australia one other time before that to another one of those shows. I think it was probably 2 years before that. And I went down a week ahead of time. It went out on a goat hunt and goat and pigs. And then came back to the show and met Kyrie. Actually, I think Kyrie came after the show. And that's when it was in Bendigo.
Yep.
And it was, Fahrenheit. I think it was 117.
Yeah. Delicious, right?
Holy cow. You guys don't mess around down there, man. When you say warm, it's warm.
Yeah, and I think that show, we were all in a big tin shed.
The solar oven.
Yep, the air conditioner had, the industrial air conditioner they had in there had broken down. Uh-huh. And I think I remember that show with the guys and girls going over to all of the hardware stores, buying every single floor fan they could possibly do and trying to jerry-rig up some cooling system at their booths. It was terrible.
Oh, yeah. It was insane. Yep.
We got to get you guys over here more often and, come and share the love of what you guys do over there and bring your craft down to Australia. It's just unreal when we get to actually see you face to face.
No doubt about it. I mean, the last time that I saw you, you'd come up here for, was it for a knife show? Was that right?
Yeah, every year for the last couple of years, I've been going to the States for Blade. So Blade Show is the biggest industry show in the world. And it is an absolute, down in Atlanta, and it's an absolute wow of a time. And I normally spend at least a month and a half in the States on a bit of a pilgrimage, I guess, if you want to say that, just heading around and going to different maker shops and hanging out with people that I'd like to go see. And the last time was before that COVID, you know, the China flu kicked off and shut down world travel. And that's been 2 years now that I've been missing the States. So, yeah, it would have been 2 years ago, South, I guess. It was my last trip over.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Seems like it's been longer than that.
Yeah. I think we both get our heads stuck into our workshop and, you know, is it Friday? Is it Monday? I don't know. It ends in Y. You know?
I know. Yeah. It's pretty funny. Is there, earlier this week, I was talking to my wife. I was like, I have no idea what day it is. And it's just like one day melts into the next. I've been working 7 days a week here for a while now trying to, you know, play catch up, and it's been just been crazy. It literally, you know, I looked at my watch today, so I know it's Thursday, and that's about as good as it gets for me.
Because you've just come back from a big traditional show, haven't you?
Yeah, we went to one at the end of January, so it's been a minute since we've been back, but we were going, you know, just crazy prepping for that show. We didn't have hardly any stock bows at the end of last year. And so, you know, I wanted to have a good showing when I showed up. And so we had, I think we went there with close to 50 bows, if I remember correctly. You know, a mixture of Stalker and A&H and some Dryad. Actually, we had over 50 if you count all three companies. But yeah, it was the strongest showing that we had as far as, you know, bringing product to a show. And so, you know, I've maintained that same kind of work pace, it seems like, since I got back. And because I kind of neglected my custom orders while we were trying to get all those stock bows built.
Yep.
So now it's been playing catch up in that regard.
Isn't that a thing when you do what you do with bows and I do with knives? They're a similar sort of, you know, similar sort of work mode, I guess, that when you're prepping for a show, it's just it's a juggling act if you've ever seen one before to try and keep all of the orders rolling at the same time build stock. It's a thing, you know. How do you find the trade shows over the last, like, one that you've just been to? I don't know whether you've been to others. Have you found things slowing down in the States?
You know, sales seem to still be doing pretty well, just like from a stock bow standpoint and then also from customs. But this is generally when we get the bulk, the first quarter of the year is when we get the bulk of our orders for guys that are wanting to get a new bow for hunting season. But when we went to that bow show, it was fairly lightly attended, which it was, you know, Michigan in the wintertime, which can be pretty touch and go from a standpoint of if the weather's really bad, then that show will typically be lightly attended. But the weather was good, and yet it was still fairly lightly attended. So I don't know if that was just, you know, residual COVID fear or what exactly to attribute it to. But, you know, it's brutal going to those shows. We were, I kind of sat down and figured it out, and we were out probably a week of production time, you know, between just packing. You know, it took us 2 days to pack all those bows up to go to the show. Then we had, you know, 3 days at the show and then another day of unpacking when we got back. And it's, you know, it gets difficult to pencil out, especially when you don't, you know, when the show wasn't all that great from a sales standpoint. So kind of, you know, really look, I had planned on going to two additional shows this year, and now I think I'm probably going to just skip them, largely because, you know, we're down a man right now, and and I've got, you know, plenty of work to do, and I really need to get the work done more than I need to get another, you know, 5 or 10 orders at this point. So
feeling that too, you know, in Australia, it's a talking to my other friends that are in industry, it's a from guiding services the whole way through, you know, whether it's guiding on animals or on trout or birds, which we're just about to kick off our bird season in Victoria on ducks. We have a season, you know, on those that's announced by the government, even though it's legislated. We have a season that's announced and how many we can shoot in a day and take, you know, in bag period and how long it's going to be. It's been, throw that into the mix, plus throw into the mix COVID, plus the world situation at the moment, you know, it's a time when you make, you know, a boutique-y, I guess if you want to say that. Is that the best word for what we do? It's a you know, it's not a need, it's a want sort of market. And hunting is something that is embedded in a whole lot of us, that's part of what we do, but when the governments have been locking us down over here in Australia and says, you know, you actually don't have a say anymore. You can't go hunting.
Right.
I mean, a lot of that stuff is just starting to lift, but we've never, ever really, from my personal point of view, seen in Australia a division amongst the states. So, you know, we have New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, ACT, Northern Territory as makes up Australia. And there was, we've never ever had this, this state's closed to that state. If you're from that state, you can't come here. We have different laws in every state. I guess in a way it's transferable. It's like, counties over in America where you might have a governor, overrule what the president says, but we've been having our, state leaders overrule what federally, it's a federal issue, you know. But we've been able to have our, somehow, had our state leaders have different rules and for every state. So, yeah, it's been an absolute terrible time trying to organise, you know, not just work, but workers. So we had to make sure that R&M Blades, it was legislated that if our workers didn't get vaccinated and get the jab, then they couldn't by law work for us.
Wow.
So it wasn't, yeah, so it's something that was taken out of our control. And I had to have a staff meeting with everyone and say, hey, guys, this is not a personal thing. This is not something that I've decided. And I'm going to leave it in your court. You know, I want you to work here. But we have to have these QR sign-in barcodes on the workshop doors. And every time you went in and out of places, you had to, like, QR code in. And if you didn't meet regulations, then you could have inspectors turn up and shut your whole workplace down. You know, and huge fines, not like $100. We're talking, you know, thousands of dollars for corporates, and like hundreds of thousands of dollars for corporates and businesses if they're found to be breaking the law. And yeah, like, it just made things very, very difficult. And even then, when you're trying to, like, we live in a, not a remote, but we certainly, when people think about remote Australia, they immediately think about Northern Territory and the desert and that sort of stuff. We live outside of a regional area, and we don't have a lot of facilities here. So everything that we rely on for work needs to get ordered in. And, you know, our business is really cash short at the moment because we had to pre-order, you know, between 3 and 6 months in front of where we normally would have had to have.
Wow, yeah. I hadn't even thought about that.
You know, cash is hard to get when everyone's hanging on to it because they don't know what's going on with COVID and whether they're going to have a job anymore. Transport slowed right down because there was drivers that were in unions, and the unions were saying, we're not going to legislate the wholesale, you know, vaccination of our workers. And then it's just turned into the biggest quagmire you've ever seen with things internationally stopping and slowing down. So, yeah, it's been a difficult time for small business, but we're getting through the other end of it, and we're hoping that kicking off 2022, we've only just been allowed to take our masks off in certain settings, which is confusing as hell because you can go and have a beer at the pub and not have your mask on, but if you go into a smaller, like the post office, you have to put your mask on. You know, you're like, what the hell?
Yeah, it's insane.
It is. So we're in Victoria is where I live in Australia, and we're about to kick off, like I said, our duck season. And we've had a whole, every year it's getting more and more debated whether we should be allowed to have a duck season, you know, even though it's legislated, and it's becoming something that you see through a lot of control elements on our social medias, even if you YouTube, you know, the demonetization of YouTube and hunting, anything that's deemed or seen to be weapon like you have to be very careful with your posts and what you say and how you say it. You know, it's really made the hunting industry it's in a period of change, put it that way.
So is your guys' duck season a political or biological reason? I mean, when I say biological, I mean like, you know, waning duck population, or is it because of it's unpopular?
That's the argument. So that's the argument that the we have what's called the Greens Party in our political system, and they stand up for what they believe in is everyone's right is, and the Greens really don't like hunting at all, to the point where they have a lot of, they talk about environmental terrorism. They actually commit a lot of terrorist-like acts on hunters. You might park your truck somewhere and come back and have all your tires not just punctured but slashed, like non-usable, you know. So that sort of stuff. So the Greens really put up a fight every year whether we should be allowed to shoot ducks. So we've had the biggest wet that we've had for around 10 years. Duck populations are absolutely booming, and there is no scientific reason as to why, this is me speaking, as to why we don't have a full season. That gets thrown up constantly. So when you think about how politicians in Australia get other bills through Parliament, they need to gander strength from across the floor, and they make promises to parties like the Greens that, hey, if you support this bill, we'll support the no duck season or tighten that up. And, you know, it's more based on the political argy-bargy than it is on anything else. You know, there's a huge resurgence, especially with the COVID stuff happening in, you know, survival, humans being able to go out and gather their own food. You know, there's dads and mums out there that want to learn how to, this might sound funny to an outdoors person that's been brought up in it, but there's people going and doing classes on how to start a fire outside.
Yeah.
You know, because people haven't, they've just lost that much. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I was listening to another podcast, earlier today or yesterday or today, I don't remember. And they're talking about, you know, how many people grow up in the city nowadays versus growing up in, you know, a more rural environment. And I guess I just totally took it for granted, having grown up out in the country, you know, all the skills that I learned, you know, out of necessity, you know, living out there in the country and you know, stuff that people that grow up in the city would never have the opportunity or the need, you know, to learn. So it is, you know, pretty interesting. And I think that those people now are starting to realize the deficit, you know, that they, you know, have in knowledge.
I think those sort of things that for you and I, let's just say we go on a hunt together, we've never ever met each other and you're taking me out onto some whitetail or whatever it is. No matter where you hunt in the world, you understand where the sun comes up in the morning, and you understand that it heats one side of a face and animals like to get warm after a cold night. Just those small basic things that you and I take for granted, And you might look at me and say, hey, Herbie, I'll catch you on that face up there in 20 minutes. I don't need to see or ask, why are we going to that face? I'm already hunting on my way there, knowing that animals are going to be making their way to that face to get warm. So there's things that are unspoken even that you just learn, I guess, no matter where you are in the world, from being outdoors. You know, which way does the wind blow? When I've had guys and girls and I've taken them out bush and the wind's clearly on the back of our ears and you can see the trees and the leaves moving that way and they get a device out of their pocket to find a wind direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're like...
Right. Won't take me that long to figure out how which way the wind's blowing here. Got a more efficient way. Do you feel it?
Yeah, you know. So it's all those sort of things that we might look at, like I said, like how to light a fire. And so, look, it's not something that I look down on people. It's like, you know, if someone put a computer in front of me and said, go and sign up to a new domain name and do this and do that, I'd be, whoa.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But if you said to me, hey, can you go and catch me a fish or kill a deer and put it on the table for seven people?
Mm-hmm.
I'm all over that.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, I've spoken about it a bit with some other people that once upon a time, and let's just roll that back to, you know, 7 million years ago, you were useful in a tribe or in a community because you did something. Like you make a bow. So you would be extremely useful in a community that needs to hunt. And your respect and your why people want to keep South alive is because you make an essential goods.
Man, I'm just born too late.
You know, some people call me fossil or dinosaur. Yeah. You know, I feel like I had been born back then. But
yeah, man, but I've, now been, social, I've been so much more valuable, you know, a few thousand years ago.
Well, you know, it's now social media puts the, unfortunately, it's what's sort of, I think has happened is that we've de-evolved and, you know, someone's important because of how many likes they've got, mm-hmm. you know, or they're following, not particularly about what they do in their community today. So a lot of those skills have fallen away because it's a society that we've grown used to of instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't do it, I'll Google it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's a lot of ladies in bikinis that are a lot more valuable than I am.
Totally. I mean, if you came to Australia and I put you in a pair of what we call budgie smugglers, which is some Speedos, you know, some swimming trunks.
I think my importance would really drop.
Boom.
Yeah. I might get shadow banned.
You know, I was thinking maybe I could get some more you know, internet traffic across my page if I was doing the same thing, you know, just wearing my leather apron in the workshop and smiling candidly back at the phone. I think I'd have the FBI turn up and investigate my...
Mm-hmm. Right, your motives. See you. Yeah.
But anyway, all of that aside, we've got... Straight out of the duck season, we're going into hog deer. So we've got the world's the only population in the world of wild hog deer that you can hunt legally, and that they're not farmed or found, you know, on game ranches. They're actually a wild density in Victoria. So you have to apply for a game tag.
Why don't you give a little bit of background on the deer in Australia, because none of them are native to Australia.
Totally.
But you have huntable populations of everything that has been introduced there, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yep. So pretty much Australia was devoid of any deer. And for whatever reasons, whether it was because gentlemen from England wanted to bring over, you know, hares, rabbits, foxes, all that sort of stuff, and bring here what they had there, deer got introduced to Australia. Our most huntable population of deer, I guess, if you want to start from the big guys, is our Sambar deer. It is, for me, it's the number one game animal in Australia.
Similar to elk kind of for us over here, I would say, huh?
Yeah, they're a big, solid, animal that doesn't vocalize at all. The Samba antlers are solid the whole way through. They just are a dense animal, man. Like 400 kilos or 800 pounds of just dense, big deer, you know. Super quiet. They're super secretive, and they're not really a herd animal, even though you will see them in, you know, up to family groups of 20 in really big, dense populations. So they are a really hard animal to hunt because they are primarily a dusk and dawn animal, although you can take them through the day. But they do present a real good challenge for certainly any hunter, whether it's from rifle through to bow. And more people are getting into the bow hunting in Australia and taking Samba with a bow, which is just unreal. So next, I guess, red deer. So red deer are a little bit like your elk in as far as their antlers are less dense than Samba. They're still a really big animal. They seem to give up a lot easier than Samba when they do get tagged. So if I've put an arrow through a Samba, I might be tracking that thing for, you know, anywhere from 50 meters to a kilometer. They just don't want to stop. You know, they're really a go-forever animal, where if you tag a red deer, they just seem to give up a lot easier. They're like, yep, you got me, you know. So you've got red deer and then, I guess, chital. So we have chital axis deer. So they are more so in the hotter regions, so back up through to northern New South Wales and Queensland. And you're familiar with what a chital deer is, you know, much finer animal, and just string jump at every opportunity. There's so many well-skilled archers that have hunted chital for a long time, and sometimes they prefer to shoot them from, say, 40 meters away than 15, because at 40 meters the deer doesn't quite hear the arrow release, and the arrow's already in the air before the deer's worked out what's going on. And then fallow deer, which are just absolutely, when you see them, they're just those big palms. They're a big palmated animal. They come in a range of colors. They're absolutely just gorgeous to see. They're sort of in that sort of mid-range in size, I guess. So probably something like white tail, maybe a bit bigger. They are a magnificent animal to see, and they have in their rut, they actually they grunt, I guess, if you want to call it that. So they make that sort of noise, and when they tip their antlers back and do that, it's just absolutely fantastic.
They run scrapes as well, right?
That's it. Yep. So they're much easier to, because they're such a vocal animal, like the red deer. The red deer actually roar. They sound a bit like a farm bull when they roar. And if you watch any of the New Zealand hunting stuff, you'll see perfect examples. And I'm not going to attempt to roar a red deer on my iPhone at the moment. I might scare everyone. But reds are the same. They'll do the same sort of thing. You know, they have their harem and they roar and vocalize to another male and show their dominance that way. So they're easier to locate. And the fallow really are going back to the fallow deer, they really are a herding animal. So you'll find them in large herds with dominant bucks. And even in the rut, there'll be five or six bucks in that particular herd all vying for, throughout the whole rut, vying for top buck. So it's a thing to see. They're absolutely magnificent. And they go really, really hard at each other too. They're sort of like big, you know, how bighorn sheep really throw themselves into their challenges, you know, and you think that they're going to break each other's heads off. Well, fallow are that aggressive that they come together like that. It's unreal. So they do fall prey to the odd rattle, so we are able to rattle them in with a rattle bag or something similar. And then we move on down to our hog deer. And our hog deer come from Sri Lanka originally, and we have probably three or four stronger groups on the coast of families, or I guess if you want to call them their own family groups. So they're spread out over quite a large area, but they're definitely not joined. They haven't joined together. So there'll be, you know, a couple of hundred kilometres between that group and this group and then the next group. And they're a tiny little deer. They're like a Labrador in size. And they are in their own home country in Sri Lanka. You can't hunt them. They're not huntable. And in Victoria, we've been able to get it legislated that we can hunt them. So we need to apply to the government to get a tag, a male and a female tag. You can only shoot one of each sex for the whole season. And you have to, once you've shot your animal, tag it, take it to what's called a checking station, where they weigh the animal, take the jawbone, a triangular cut out of its tongue, and use that for DNA and scientific purposes and stuff like that. Then you can take your hog deer home and do what you'd like with it. So
now the hog deer, that's the only deer that has a season down there in Australia. Is that right? As far as a hunting season, you'd equate to what we have here in the States, and the rest are open year round, no bag limit.
Pretty much. So it's a difficult thing for Australians to sort of that haven't travelled or haven't spoken to friends in the US or whatever. But you guys are really short on all your seasons and bags on all your different species and the different rules in every state. In Australia, pretty much as long as you have the correct paperwork as far as if you're firing, if you're using a firearm, you need to have a firearms license. So as long as you're doing that and you've got a permit to operate in that state, so you may have to apply for a game license in New South Wales, where I've got a game license for Victoria as a permanent thing. I now have a permanent New South Wales, which is our sister state, so I can cross the border. You just need to make sure that you've got that stuff sorted. Mm-hmm. So, and outside of that, look, I could shoot 15, 20 Samba deer in a night if I wanted to. You know, there's, and why I say shoot them at night times, because there's a lot of control permits. There's a lot of private land holdings that you don't have to even have a game license to shoot them on. There's a few little tricky things around the law there. That's been implemented to be able to take away some of the red tape of the farmers, the guys that are really suffering from residential populations on their large holdings, and the Samba deer might be mowing through a whole bunch of their corn or green feed that they're trying to grow for their cattle. Uh-huh. So they can just shoot them pretty much without a game license and deal with the population that way. So we're pretty blessed in Australia, yeah.
I guess. Boy, yeah, it's pretty funny. I am the first time I went down there to Australia, Antonio Lara, he used to have South Pacific Bowhunter, had invited me to come down, and I was talking to a group of bowhunters down there, and I think I, you know, told them I had, you know, quite proudly taken a couple of mule deer, you know, in one season on two different hunts with my stick bow, and he kind of pulls me aside later and's like, you might not want to, you know, say that, because down here, some of these guys are shooting, you know, 20 or 30 in a, you know, in a year. Yep. And it's just like, holy smokes, the amount of opportunity that you guys have down there is just unreal. And then, I mean, consequently, the amount that you learn and how effective of a hunter that you can become, because you get to, you know, so many opportunities and so much time in the field, because you're not, you know, narrowed down to a 3 or 4 week long season with one tag. Yeah. You know, it's pretty incredible.
Well, it's got to the point where if you said to me a year and a half ago that the government in Victoria is going to start heli-culling our wild deer population, mm-hmm. we would have said, no way, no, that will never happen. Well, the Victorian government has been pouring literally millions into a shooting program where we had some really big bushfires, and it's removed a lot of the canopy, so it makes it easier for the helicopters to find the deer, and they've been going hell for leather shooting as many deer as I possibly can, and for a, you know, we need to control populations. That's a scientifically proven thing across the world. We understand that. It just makes it a hard pill to swallow when you've got to pay to hunt an animal that the government is paying to get shot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Particularly when we have, so we mightn't have a season, but we have our alpine areas that we're allowed to hunt deer in certain months, and that's it. Because of the cross-pollination of usage of the same area. So you might have the Alpine National Park open to a lot of families, and it's getting hotter and that sort of stuff. So they close the hunting season down, so to speak, for a couple of months, then reopen it. But you're only allowed, you've got to pay to go and hunt these animals. And a lot of the hunters didn't have a problem with they did have a problem, but they had less of a problem with a helicopter shooting deer in areas that you weren't allowed legally to access ever anyway, because there are wilderness areas that you're just not allowed to hunt in. So we were like, if that has to happen, go for it. Fill your boots. Do what you've got to do, you know. But there's guys that wait all year for what we call gate opening, when they open the gate to the park, and the deer have been rested, so to speak, and it's still like a slug. You still got to put your pack on. You can park in a car park, but you've still got to walk all day to get to some of these areas, you know. But guys just froth on that, and they really hang out for that every year. Then they started shooting the deer like a week before gate opening in our huntable areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that really rubbed us up the wrong way.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. You know?
Mm-hmm. You're like, what, you know? So... anyway, we could be political all day. It's something that, you know, we have to deal with, I think, as the hunting community, as an international thing. And my personal belief, from what we see in Australia, in Australian culture, is that if we don't, as hunters, get that message of that paddock to plate message across, I couldn't have 8 people sit in a room that have never hunted before and don't have an opinion either way, and take just a rack in and say, this is why I hunt for this,
mm-hmm.
and get it over the line. But if I took in a barbecue,
mm-hmm.
and said, sample all of this and tell me what you think, that's why I hunt.
Yeah.
I'm going to get it across the line as to why I hunt a lot easier through food.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that food message is hell of a lot important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's times, and like, I hunt primarily for food. It was only the other day, the first time in about a year and a half, I've been to the butchers. You know, lockdown's really drained my freezer.
Mm-hmm.
That I hunt primarily for food, but there are days when I do just think, you know what? I know where a really big, hard to get rack is, and I just want to shoot that animal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way that the world's going, and you know, the desensitization of so many different things, we really do need to work on that paddock to plate message and self-sustainability for true, not just for a sponsorship from a company or whatever else, that it's what you actually believe in, that you have where you can have your vegetable garden and you can have your backyard chickens, and you know, you go into the woods and you supplement what you do at home with what you get from the woods, and just be a better community as humans. You know, so, yeah.
Well, you guys are starting to open back up again down there, if I'm not mistaken, right, as far as opportunities and the mask mandates are getting lifted. And so you guys are able to travel around between provinces down there?
States. Yep.
Yeah, between states. And what's it look like for foreigners coming in? Do you guys, somebody coming in, do they have to be vaccinated, or are they even allowing foreigners to come into Australia at this point?
So it's not that your question's confusing, but the answer is.
Sort of.
Yep. Is that an easy thing to say? And which way the wind blows today is different tomorrow. So. Sure. Different states, once again, this should be a federal thing, so it's easy for everyone, you know, the whole way through to our hospitality and our tourism industry can actually get back on their feet. It's a hard message to get across, because what happens in Victoria is different to what's happening in, say, Western Australia, where they've got a complete lockdown, where we can't even travel to Western Australia as Australian residents.
Wow.
So
who would want to go over there anyway?
I know, right? It's a desert. It's just hot and horrible.
unless you want to go work in a mine.
So that's we are opening up our borders. We are having people coming flying in internationally. It's becoming easier to do that. You just got to really see what happens, I guess, if you are booking to come over, as to where the best flight plan is. So you may be able to fly into, say, Sydney with no quarantine period and then travel to Victoria and not have to – this is how crazy it is, and which is just a state above us. Mm-hmm. So you could – you know, it's a maybe a 10-hour drive, which is not a lot really. So you fly into Sydney, then travel to Victoria. But if you flew into Victoria, for example, I'm not saying it's true, but if you fly into Victoria, you may have to quarantine for 7 days before you do anything.
Right.
So it's just a matter of knowing whereabouts in Australia you want to go, checking the current legislation for that, seeing if there's a faster way to get yourself to where you got to go, but still complying with the national laws and regulations. So outside of smuggling yourself inside a shipping container, there are other ways to get to Australia and get around some of that stuff.
Right.
We're actually planning to go to New Zealand. There's a little bunch of us, a group of us that we've been busting to get back to New Zealand. It's an absolute magnificent place to go. And we're planning in late October, November to head to New Zealand and do a bit of hunting for a week or so over there. And we've got to do exactly the same thing. We've got to check out flying from Australia to New Zealand, which part of New Zealand we can actually fly into. We haven't got time because we all own our own businesses to actually be held up somewhere for days doing isolation here or there or whatever else. We just want to fly in, go meet our guy, get on the helicopter. We're going to get helicoptered into the Alps and go hunt, then helicopter back and fly back to Australia. We have to do quite a lot of homework around where, how, who and what company. So, yeah, it's just not a simple thing, unfortunately.
Yeah. I know New Zealand, they've really got hit with the lockdown and their restrictions getting in and out of the country. I think that, I mean, by and large, it sounds like within the country, it remained, you know, pretty free.
Open.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's... I guess be glad if you were wanting to travel internationally, you weren't living in... New Zealand there.
They really did that because they, you know, they went hard early on the COVID stuff and it seemed that their numbers and infection rates and stuff certainly got under control, you know, but we could talk about that all day too. Yeah. New Zealand, you know, it's, New Zealand is just, all I can say is travel to Australia or New Zealand if you want to do some awesome out there stuff, you know, like Lord of the Rings is filmed. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, that's what you're hunting in,
right?
You know, when you're in those glacial peaks and you've got valleys that are full of ice and you hear that Mordor, you know, like the cracking of the ice, you know, and you're on one side of it, you know, hiking up to your next glacier to be able to hunt tar or whatever else. You know, last time I went, I took one of your bows over. I trad bow hunted tar and chamois over there. And, you know, people looking at me like in their New Zealand accent, you know, chur, bro. You know? thinking that I'd never get it done, and I didn't. I got within 100 meters of some animals, and they just look at you and blink, and then they're gone straight up the mountain, you know, and they've gained 2.5 kilometers in elevation before you've even thought about taking your pack off, you know.
Right.
But it's just an absolutely magnificent experience.
Yeah, it's on my list, and it's on my list to make it back down there to Australia at some point too, and I'd really like to come down. So April, if you're wanting to deer hunt down there, April's probably the month to shoot for, huh?
Yep, it's you can still hunt your sambar. The sambar aren't rutting, but they're certainly about. You can hunt your fallow deer have come into rut then, so your fallow will certainly be fired up. Your red deer may still be in rut at that point in time. And you've got your hog deer as well. So it's really not a bad time of the year to come. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. You know, I really love, I don't know what's happened to me. I grew up in Sydney, on the outskirts of Sydney, in sort of 42 degrees Celsius, you know.
Which is and love hot.
Yep. And now that I've moved to Victoria and I live at the base of the mountains, if it gets to like 20 degrees Celsius, I'm cooking and I'm hating it. Uh-huh. You know? So, it's a great time to come. Yep.
Right. Yeah. So 42 degrees is 107.6 Fahrenheit. So, yeah, for me, I mean, I'm up here in the mountains in Estes and Estes Park here in Colorado, and we're at 7,500 feet. And you go down the mountain a couple thousand feet lower, and it'll be, you know, in the summer, it'll be easy 20 degrees hotter, you know, but a hot day for me up here is we get into the 80s. And then, you know, if we get into the mid to upper 80s, I'm dying, you know. Really makes me feel pretty wimpy, but man, I'll tell you what, I sure love the cooler temperatures.
Look, when I fly over to Blade every year, I fly to North Carolina, or well, I fly into New York as we all do, then go to, I've got a buddy, Chris Williams, who lives over in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And that time of year, man, it is just like sticky and hot.
The humidity is brutal.
Oh, it's just terrible. Even the squirrels in the trees are looking at with their tongues hanging out, going, man, like.
Yeah, no doubt. And they're wishing for a case of mange.
Totally, you know. Uh-huh. Get it off me, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and then to go down to Atlanta, oh, my Lord, Atlanta just gets super duper hot. It's just, yeah, but yeah, not good, not cool. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So apart from that, what I guess to talk about education and stuff, a really good friend of mine, Brad Murphy, who's you know, been hunting backwards and forwards internationally for the last 10 years from Europe to United States, mm-hmm. Holds a couple of Australian 3D titles, so national titles. He's been shooting a long time, is a qualified physiotherapist, understands how the body works, mechanics, all that sort of stuff. He's a couple of years ago set up, because there's no real official coaches course over here, so not like your Tom Clums, that sort of stuff, you right. know. He started a small business and called himself on social media the Bow Hunting Coach. Mm-hmm. More so just to get people with their wheelie bows with compounds to get just those basic form stuff correct.
Yeah.
Because so many people were having injuries turning up to his and he was seeing it and that sort of stuff because they had their shoulders all wrong, holding the bow wrong. Mm-hmm. So he branched out into that. Anyway, East Gippsland is where I live, and we are really devoid of any sort of that sort of education. And I brought his program to East Gippsland about 12 months or so ago. And we took, I think it was maybe only 10 or 12 students in the first course, just showing people how your bow works, setting it up, getting them on the range, just hitting the target, not even so much aiming, but just, you know, getting all your form right because your aiming comes next.
Yeah.
And we're talking about it afterwards about how and what we could do to improve the course. So we've now come up with a course criteria, and we're running our very first one at the end of this month where we're going to split the course. We've got, I think, 22 or 23 students. And we're going to, for the whole, we've got Friday night or Friday afternoon, Friday night, Saturday and Sunday. We're going to split the course in half over the period of that weekend. So Brad's going to take half of the students. I'm going to take the other half. So I'll have 10 or 12 and Brad will have 10 or 12. Brad will do, say, from 8 o'clock in the morning through to midday. Mm-hmm. He'll do the theory and the hunting archer is what we're aiming it at. Do that with those guys while I'll run over field skills from everything from how to pack your pack to survival shelters, how to get wet water when you've run out, you know, all those sort of bits and pieces that are sort of like the other half of packing your pack to go bow hunting. You might have a bow in the backyard and you can fling sticks all day, but if you don't know how to actually get to your hunting area and set yourself up and stay clean for a week.
Right.
That's the missing part.
Yeah.
And then we've got a Michelin star chef who's going to do tasting plates to show people how to actually get the best out of their animal. Going to do cut up and cook up and all that sort of stuff. And then we're going to swap the groups around. So the guys that were with me in the morning, we'll go with Brad in the afternoon and Vicky Verka.
Yeah.
We're going to have our area paramedic, our guy that looks after all of the from rural paramedics to their specialist guys. He's in charge of all of them. He's going to come and do all of those sort of first aidy type stuff. So I don't know, maybe you know someone that stood on a broadhead when they're blood trialing a deer.
Sounds familiar.
When you got a Valkyrie sticking out of your ankle and you still track your deer down.
Right.
But that aside, they're the sort of things that you don't expect to happen, and how do I deal with it, you know? A couple of years ago, there was a young hunter, young as in age in the hunting world, not as in actual biological age, and was could see a deer and was hunting the deer and had the arrow on the rest while he was doing that the whole time, like a couple of hundred meters, you know, and then tripped. And the arrow that was on the rest then went straight into his quad. And then, yeah, he's sort of like looking at that thinking, well, what do I do now? I've got a broadhead that hasn't come out.
Right.
It's in my leg. How do I deal with this? So we don't plan for that. So that's what I'm going to be covering off on. And that's what our paramedic guy is going to give some clues, I guess, onto how to do that for yourself. Or if you come across a buddy that's laying underneath a tree and has got a similar injury, how they actually get around that and live to fight another day, so to speak.
Yeah, important stuff there to know. And that's fantastic for somebody who's, you know, wanting to get into hunting, because the barrier to entry can seem, I would imagine, insurmountable from and overwhelming from, you know, a newbie standpoint. There's so many different skills to learn, because not only are you learning how to shoot a bow, but then, like you've pointed out, all the woodsmanship skills that you need to know to kind of go along with it, not to mention then, you know, animal habits and so that's a great program. I don't know that there's really that, despite the number of hunters that we have here in the States. I mean, there's on a small scale, you know, regionally in pockets, I think there's that kind of thing going on, but it would be really neat to see that kind of on a national scale.
Well, that's where we want to head for it. I think the education, no matter what it is key.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to do that and to grow it from there to, you know, maybe making it a 3-day camp, you know, and being able to really have a solid 3 days and have subject matter experts, not just guys that have done it a little bit and are just going to throw their two bob into the ring, you know, that actually – like the paramedic, like the cook, people that actually value add to the program, so the participants go away with real time, up to date, you know, from hygiene to food prep to, you know, that's what we want our people to be able to get, you know.
Right.
I think, you know, the other thing that really, you know, we're going to cover off on, if you remember back to your first night ever camped out on your own in a remote area that had a predator population in it.
Yeah, you don't sleep very well.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So we're going to cover off on getting comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with coming back and saying, I absolutely crapped myself all night.
Yeah.
Or worst case scenario, like you might know someone that got mauled by a bear, you know. I seem to be using you for an example
right,
but if your buddy's so injured and can't come out of the mountain with you, and you need to go and get help, and you know that you're going to have your buddy spend a night, how do you make your buddy comfortable so that they can at least suffer through the night with their injury or whatever it is and not feel like they have to move? So basic things like building a lean-to, you know, a very simple structure. Humans feel so much more comfortable when they've got one of their – when they've got their six covered off, basically, you know. And if you can back up against a wall of something, whether it's a rock or, like I said, a lean-to, and have a fire out the front of you, it takes us back to those cave days, right, where you feel a little bit like your back's protected and your front's protected by fire, that if you can do that for your buddy, that's a simple thing that can make their night a lot more comfortable than just leaving them in the middle of the day and not thinking about that and going, well, I'll be back. And then an hour into dark, you hear, and you're like,
Yeah.
You know, so we'll cover off on all that stuff, which is going to be great, you know, I think, from everything from how to sharpen your broadheads to sharpening knives, you know. I've sharpened a couple of knives in my lifetime, so I should be able to impart some sort of knowledge on that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and actually, speaking of that, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, or we didn't talk about your knife business as we're getting close to an hour here. It's R&N Blades, and they're all handmade, you know, in Australia with U.S. steel, and you offer, you know, quite a few different blade styles and, you know, antler and bone and a wide variety of wood handle options. But so why don't we back up and how did you get into making knives?
So I was in the police force for a long time. And I got medically retired with post-traumatic stress disorder. Towards the end of my career, I went to 13 bad deaths in 3 months, and a lot of them were kids, you know, and that kind of really shook my brain up a bit. So I was always interested in knives, and so that's that part. I had to put that there to put context to what I'm going to say.
Sure.
So I grew up on a farm, and always for us, a knife, our granddad was always asking, you know, at different times, he'd ask us to pull our pocket knife out and inspect how sharp it was, because it was seen as a tool, you know, on a farm. You need a sharp knife, whether you're going to cut hay band or cut the tops off carrots or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, it was something you need to learn to keep sharp. So from an early age, I fell into just that love of watching granddad just being able to lick up a blade in 3 seconds and think, wow, like, and his knives were scary sharp, you know. And I just loved making knives from back then on the farm, you know, mucking around with different steels and broken bits and pieces of implements that I'd heat up and shape and grind into things that I thought were unreal, that were, you know, probably nothing more than now a sharp piece of steel. When I went through the police stuff, I had a small workshop set up that I actually found was my escape, being able to put my headset on, stand in front of a grinder and make something with my own hands. Really transported me to a place outside of the stuff I'd seen at work all day, and was able to quiet that in my brain. So I found it to be very therapeutic to be able to start something and finish it and then have value on what I'd made with my own hands. And the value that other people saw in it as well was, you know, I guess filling my cup back up. So in 2010, we got to the position where I was making enough knives that I needed to knuckle down and create a business, in as far as there's different tax laws in Australia, and I knew that we were heading that direction, and I needed to actually get a Australian business number, an ABN, and start our business. So we established as a business in 2010, even though we were making knives prior to that as a hobbyist. And it was actually my savior when I, in 2014, was when I retired from the police force. I had something to do that kept me out of being on a whole bunch of drugs and PTSD stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it really sort of segued into where we are today. We make our knives from S35VN. Which comes from Niagara Specialty Metals. It's crucible-made steel. It just offers so much toughness compared to a whole lot of other steels that we have used, for its usability, ability for someone to sharpen it, all those sort of bits and pieces.
So the S is for stainless, is that correct? Uh-huh. And then what's the V?
For vanadium, and the N is for niobium. So the 35 itself has no other significance other than to differentiate between S30V, which was its predecessor. Mm-hmm. So all steels need to have carbon in it, and it needs to have some carbides in it to create a cutting edge, I guess. And the difference between the S30V and S35VN, well, S35VN is composed of about 1.5% carbon, 14% chromium, 3% vanadium, 2% molybdenum, and about 0.5% of niobium.
Those sound like a lot of stuff you'd be ingesting as supplements.
Oh, look, I tell you, I could get into the metallurgy of it, and it would really make your eyes roll back like a crocodile in a pond and think, wow, okay, it's a whole lot of words. Uh-huh. But they're the things that actually matter when these companies make the steel. You know, that carbon's the most essential element in the hardness of any steel, uh-huh. and the higher the carbon content, the harder the knife is.
Okay.
So when compared with other alloys, including chromium and vanadium, carbides are formed which are harder than just the carbon alone. So there's carbides and carbon.
Okay.
And the carbon content is very similar in our S35VN to the S30V, but the carbide has been improved with the niobium. So that's a whole lot of dishwater for some people, but basically we make our steel out of the best steel that we've found available on the market. We love what comes out of the USA for all of the a whole bunch of reasons. So, and it's not just me trying to be patriotic or sound like USA, USA, mm-hmm. but the company itself has just been so stand-up-ish, it's just unreal. Just, you know, what they say they do. And I know that every piece of steel that I get from those guys has minimal inclusions, and that it's just not made out of old Toyotas and you know, Coca-Cola cans, and they've stamped it S35VN. They've right. actually got a lot of time, and they put their name on their product. So it really helps us when we are an end user of that steel to be able to have confidence that you, as the person in the field using it, are going to get a absolute race car of a piece of steel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to cut and cut and cut and really perform for you.
And consistency, you know, imagine as
it's
well.
It's key.
Yeah.
It has to be. Mm-hmm. So many other steel companies from around the world, I mean, there's some other really good steels out there, don't get me wrong, and there's some other really good companies. But for me, I can put my hand on my heart and know that that steel is exactly that steel, that it hasn't undergone some other weird transformation in its creation, and it's got big lumps of crap in it. It's just, you know, it's going to heat treat well. The heat treat's going to be, you know, on point all the time. The grain structure is going to be really good inside the, if you broke it in half, the grain structure after heat treatment's going to be just the same every time, you know. So
yeah, I can remember sharpening, you know, sharpening broadheads. You know, on occasion you'll get a hard spot, you know, on the edge of the blade of the broadhead. And it's like it's a piece of carbide or something that's got, you know, gotten into the steel. And man, you cannot – it's like your file just rides over that as a speed bump.
Yeah. Well, they're all the things that, you know, so the like when we talk about the S35VN, vanadium, it's essential to balance that toughness with its wear resistance. So not only does it increase the strength and toughness, but it also promotes – that fine grain structure we're talking about and forms those hard carbides, and it just dramatically intensifies the edge holding. So I think that they've really done super, super well with this steel. It is a little expensive, So if anyone's listening and they're thinking, cool, I'll go out and grab some S35VN, which you can buy from any of the knife, you know, warehouses or wholesalers as a piece of steel, I'd probably say start off with some 440C or some D2 or something like that. It's going to be a bit kinder to the new maker. Mm-hmm. It's a technical steel. It is a fantastic steel, but it's kind of like if I walked into your shop and you said, well, there's a piece of wood, make a bow. Mm-hmm.
Right.
There's a lot of other things that I need to do to learn how to make the bow.
Yeah. <laughs> You know?
So, yeah, it's a good thing. A business itself, it's just growing. We're sort of like, you know, a water balloon full of river rocks. We're just bulging out at the edges everywhere.
Right.
We need to look at moving to a bigger floor space. So we've got more real estate in the actual factory itself. We need to put more machinery in. And as you know, doing what you do, that introduction of a CNC machine, something similar to that.
Yeah.
You know, time's money, right? Mm-hmm. And we haven't got the floor space to put that in there. So we're looking really hard to find a place. We need, the problem is that there's lots of places that have got lots of space, but none of them have, you know, three phase. So a lot of our industrial machines run off three phase machinery.
Right. Yeah.
And it's getting harder to find.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to be moving to a website soon.
Pretty remarkable, I mean, how far you've come and managed to not have a website. You've pretty well conducted your business just on Facebook, from what I understand, right?
Yep. And Peter just messaged us. Mm-hmm. But I've had a couple of really good conversations with some other guys that are in small business and big business. And I've been so busy, which is a failure of mine in a way as a business owner or manager. And I've said, hey, look, I'm just too busy to set up a website. But that is a big part of working in your business or working on your business. Mm-hmm. So these things only become apparent when you get to the stage of growth that you need it.
Right.
So we're finding it very difficult, you know, 65 inquiries a day, trying to get back to that many inquiries a day on social media.
That's
insane, right?
Yeah.
So my wife's flat out. She's a nurse. She's a pretty highly trained nurse, and she's still nursing 2 days a week, even though she's meant to be working full time for us, just the way the COVID stuff is and all the rest of it. So she's away 2 days a week. I'm trying to do that. We've got staff that we have to manage, jobs in, jobs out. It's going to cut a whole bunch of those questions out as well, like what type of steel is this? So we've got a whole lot of new followers or people that are interested. How thick is it? How big is it? Can I get this on it? Can I get that on it? Like, that all takes time to answer, right?
Yeah.
So if we've just got that web information on our page, that's hopefully going to reduce a lot of that traffic. And the other thing that a mate said to me the other day, who's well and truly ingrained in the business side of things, and he said, if I was a bigger business looking to either hitch my cart to you, or I was someone that didn't know who R&M Blades was, and someone said to me, yeah, they actually don't have a website, you can only contact the guy by social media. Does it start to sound a bit dodgy? How reliable is this guy going to be? What sort of business is he running?
Do I really want to send this guy a deposit and then never hear from him again?
Yep. So it's opening your eyes up to that side of things that you might never have thought of, because you had your head so full of steel dust that you're busy making stuff that you're not actually busy making your business.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's been really good to be able to sit back and look at that. We're pretty excited. It might sound like it, but we're pretty excited about this next step. It's going to be a whole lot of work. We've got to get product photos, upload them, make sure that the photos are good, do all of that stuff from information management. So when someone logs on, you know, and puts all their details in there to buy a product, you know, all the back end stuff that people don't think about with websites.
Yep.
Returns policies, all those sort of bits and pieces. We've got to make sure that it's all right, and then we'll launch sooner than later, hopefully. So
do you have a name for your, obviously it's R&M Blades, but is it because I know you can't use the and symbol when.
No, that's it.
Yeah.
Yep. So I think I'll just call it HerbiesWorldDomination.com.
Well, at least certainly leaves room to branch out into other fields, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the teething stuff that we're getting around. I've engaged a guy that's all over that social media and website development stuff, and been able to make sure that what we've been known as a business, people will search for and still find it. So they're the things that I didn't think of, you know, that when you do R and that little squiggly and N, and it's Robert and Naomi is what it stands for, Robert and Naomi Blades. If I'd known that I couldn't use that in a web page, I probably would have made a little difference in the what we called our business and branded it as.
Sure.
So I'm more than happy to learn. I think that any day that you're not learning is a day that you should probably go check yourself out in the mirror, you know. Yeah. And that's the stuff that I'm excited about. Really, like making a really good solid knife is making a really good solid business, you know.
Right.
I need something that also in, say, 15 years' time when I might want to retire, I can either float and put up for sale. That means that the business collapses if Robert Herbert's not there. Someone's actually got a viable business, you know. So, yeah, that's all exciting stuff to sort of grow towards and – yeah, happy days.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you know, I tell people a lot, when I'm talking about, you know, small business within the traditional archery industry, I mean, it's such a niche market and it's, such a small community, you know, in perspective to the rest of the world that, you know, once you kind of start to get your name out there, you don't really have to do a lot of things right from a marketing standpoint to, you know, start to get some recognition and start to build a business. But to really do it right, and I'm by no stretch of the imagination saying that I'm any model of doing it correctly, but, you know, I've gotten a fair share of market you know, fair market share and market recognition. And
yep.
I like to tell people I'm not necessarily doing it right. I'm just the tallest of the midgets.
And you can say that.
Right. Yeah. Not being a skyscraper myself in stature. Yeah.
Well, I was talking to Ken Onion the other day. I'm really lucky that I've got people like Bill Harsey, you know, Curtis Levito from Spartan Blades, Bill Harsey's from, you know, the Chris Reeve lineup, Ken Onion, and I'm not just name dropping these actual guys that I can do what I'm doing with you. I could ring them and say, hey, I'm stuck with this or that, or how do I make this better? And I was talking to Ken the other day, and you know, we sort of came to that conclusion that trees take a long time to grow,
yeah,
and weeds come and go overnight,
right?
So true. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of take that message away and think about that, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, there are a lot of flash in the pans, you know, where somebody gets inspired, thinks they want to do something, and then they jump into it, get going on it, and then realize it's a lot of work, and then decide that maybe it's not for them. And so you get a lot of, you know, the same thing in the traditional bow industry. There's a lot of bowyers that come and go, and there's not a whole lot of them that stick, and there's not very many of them that, you know, are large enough to have employees. And I would imagine it's the same thing in the knife, you know, custom knife industry as well.
Totally. I mean, it's one thing to make one knife, and there's a whole bunch of awesome makers and they make one incredible looking knife.
Mm-hmm.
Then if I said to them, I need you to make 50 of those.
Right.
And make them exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. The shine wears off it after about the third knife.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's the sort of thing that, you know, going from the guy in the garage to actually running a business in whatever it is that you do, that's the stuff that you've got to think about, you know.
Right.
And a whole bunch of other stuff, you know. But look, we're really happy. We've got dealers all over the world, and our dealers aren't like what you'd find, I guess, in the States. They're actual people that, well, I shouldn't say that because it's a weird thing to say because it's our what coming from Australian culture. It's not just a business deal, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. They're actual people that I know and trust mm-hmm. and trust with our brand. And they are either outdoors persons themselves and they have their own outdoor stores or they are purely just a knife trader. Yeah, we're really proud of what we've been able to do internationally. We've built previously for Kafaru, sent a couple of blades over to you, mm-hmm. You know, Germany, soon to be England, New Zealand, our domestic market, our ADF. Yeah, we build for a whole bunch of different people. And yeah, we're really proud of what we've done.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a handful of your knives on our website. And I know when I first met you, you did almost all, you know, bone or antler mm-hmm. handles. And now you've done, you'll start doing a lot more wood, man. I can't imagine having to cut that much antler. That stuff, I mean, I do, you know, antler tips and antler finger overlays, and it's like about runs me out of the shop when I have to put that stuff on the bandsaw. I can't imagine doing that just day in and day out.
Oh, my Lord, I tell you, my wife won't let me in the house. Uh-huh. I'm not just being colloquial, is it? She will not let me in the house unless I've had an air shower with the airbrush, and then I've taken a shower before I actually come to the rest of the house. You know?
Right.
You know, when I might have to duck down the street to the post office, and I've been cutting bone all morning, you wonder why people are looking at you really funny.
Glancing at you sideways. Did that dude just butcher somebody, or?
Yep, it's a. Yeah, it's a thing.
Well, I mean the amount of knives that you see, and so if you look for on Instagram, it's Robert_Herbert Herbert, and so it's not R&N Blades on Instagram. So you don't make yourself easy to find. I'll give you that for starters. And then, so Facebook, is it R&N Blades or is it Robert Herbert on Facebook also?
It's R&N Blades on Facebook because I do have a Robert Herbert page, which I'd never use because I just post to Instagram and it just, you know, how Instagram marries it up to your Facebook account. So you'll see the same thing appear on the Instagram on Robert_Herbert and the Facebook page of R&N Blades. Yeah. And that's all stuff that I've got to tidy up. So, you know,
You get a chance to see though some of the handles and the blades, you know. But I mean, I'm such a wood junkie myself that what gets me excited is when I see the Damascus stuff, and then it's like, ooh, you know, then I'm looking at the blade itself. But otherwise, I'm always staring at the handle.
Yep. Well, we've got a few couple of new models coming out. We're really trying to diversify a little bit with some stuff. It all takes time, though. Product development is something that we take seriously, and we just don't make something overnight and think that looks good, then we'll just go to production with that. We actually like to get it out into our test and design crew. We've got a test and design crew that have other jobs, but they are out there all the time. And we get feedback, but we're pretty excited about some new stuff that's coming out anyway. So, and some new direction with business. So,
right on.
Stay tuned, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess probably the best thing to do would be to follow you on Instagram or Facebook so that you can kind of get a heads up on when that new website drops, huh?
For sure. And, you'll see a whole lot of shop tips in there as well. We do a lot of videos of how to's. And I don't know how many new makers message me just for, hey, what's your thoughts on this? Or what do you think of this design? Don't be afraid to send me a message. I'm a pretty personable sort of guy. And I can give some advice from my experience of making knives and what works and what doesn't. I had a fellow the other day, he wanted to make a knife, and his first knife ever that he wanted to make was a replication of the Puma White Hunter's POW. Oh, no, it was the... the big bullnose one. What's that one? That's White Hunter, I think it is. And it is a technical multiple ground knife. And I was like, dude, Let's just start with a 3-inch blade.
Right, baby steps, right?
Yeah, you know, so, yeah, always happy to ask. And we do ship internationally, and that's not a sales point. A lot of people ask, hey, would you ship to the States? And we ship a lot of knives to the States. So we typically stay away from the quarter-inch stock purely for the fact that it's an Australian, New Zealand sort of thing, I guess, that we prefer a thinner stock, but the steel that we use is still super strong, and you get a really, we're not making miniature field axes, we're actually making a cutting implement. Mm-hmm. So our knives are typically a lot thinner than what you might see in the States, because the States, and I've got a lot of mates that make in the States, so this isn't a negative thing, but a lot of the guys like that quarter inch stuff. Mm. We have thinner knives, but they cut and cut and cut and cut. So, and you'll still use them all day in the field, chopping stuff and doing whatever else. So, right. Lifetime warranty.
Good deal.
Good to go.
Hey, one last question I had for you, and maybe I should have dove into this earlier, but sharpening. What's your recommended, like for field sharpening, your recommended method and or you know, instrument or tool that you use for sharpening?
Yep. Easy. Worksharp field sharpener is probably the best product that I've ever found or seen. It will take an experienced guy and a brand new guy, a newbie, to the same level really quickly. So they have drop-in guides on each side, so they're actually attached. So it's the Worksharp Field Sharpener. Worksharp is just an awesome company. They really do understand the product. They understand what is required from a knife point of view. Stand by their product, and that Worksharp Field Sharpener, 17 to 20 degrees is what you mostly should need on all of your field knives. If you have a Lansky or you have a Wicked Edge or any of those, sort of like just be hitting off on those sort of degrees, 17, 20 degrees. But if you just wanted to stick something in your pack or in the kitchen, check out Worksharp. They have a bench model, which is a big model, which you could use in the kitchen or in the workshop. And they have a small packable field sharpener, and that is just the ants pants.
So I just pulled up on the website here. It's actually sharpeningsupplies.com. And so there's a Worksharp precision adjust knife sharpener that's 50.
Not that one.
Okay. Then there's one that comes in a little kit, like a little pouch there, that zippered pouch. Worksharp precision adjust. Okay, that's an upgrade kit. Then there's one that looks like it has a little belt sander. Then there's Worksharp angle set knife sharpener.
Just the field sharpener. Okay. Worksharp field sharpener. I should take you there anyway, somewhere.
Field sharpener. I just want to. Okay.
It is probably one of the most. Worksharp guided field knife sharpener is the long one for it. Worksharp guided field sharpener.
Okay, got it. Yep. $30. Yep.
So there you go.
Inexpensive and looks packable there as well.
Very. And you do broadheads on it. It's actually got a broadhead wrench. So underneath the diamond plates, you take the diamond plates are interchangeable, so you can change them out when you wear them out. And man, I've had mine for like 2.5 years. I'm on one of them still, you know. You can flip those plates out. There's a ceramic sharpening rod that's in it that you can do all your serrations. It's got and I don't work for Worksharp. Mm-hmm. I just really like to pump products at work. And it's got a leather strop on it. It's an all-in-one thing, and you'll find it pretty easily. So the Worksharp guided field sharpener.
Here we go. So that one's $50.
Because there's a real small version of it and a bigger version of it, and the WSGF S221 is the actual code for it. So Worksharp guided field sharpener, the bigger version of it, it'll do you all day, and you can do all your broadheads, all your fish hooks, all your serrations, all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
So the smaller one, is that just a ceramic rod in that one?
Like. Yeah, it's just a smaller version, because everyone likes, you know, some people like to cut their toothbrush in half when they're backpacking,
right,
you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Indeed.
Look, I've just found as I've got older, you know, things hurt a lot more. So when I've got a big samba on the ground and I'm halfway through dressing it, my back's normally hurting anyway, rolling around 800 pounds a mate.
Yeah.
I take that opportunity to stand up, stretch my back, pull my sharpener out, and just drop the knife back up if I need it, you know. And that's what I recommend people do, so that they've constantly got their knife in tip-top condition, that it is razor sharp. It's like when you're using a chainsaw, when it's throwing dust and not chips anymore, you should have stopped and sharpened it four rings ago.
Sure.
You know, it's much easier to maintain a sharp knife than a super dull knife and bring it back to its razor edge.
Right, right. Yep. Oh, good deal. Well, I appreciate the time that you've given the audience and myself here, Herbie. It's good to catch up with you again, and I'm looking forward to seeing that website and you step into the 22nd century.
Out of the cave.
There you go. Yeah, no more Neanderthal.
Korg must grind knife.
Right. Yep. Yeah,
good deal. You'll
graduate from stone to steel.
Yeah. Well, Australia only got electricity like 2 years ago, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it's the damn kangaroos.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Right on.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to talk to you again.
Always, mate.
All right.
Chat soon.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. Marco!